All right, thanks. Our first reading is from Luke, chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. In those days, a decree went out from the Emperor Augustus that all the world should be registered. This was the first registration and was taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went to their own towns to be registered. Joseph also went from the town of Nazareth in Galilee to Judea, to the city of David called Bethlehem. Because he was descended from the house and family of David, he went to be registered with Mary, to whom he was engaged and who was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for her to deliver her child, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in bands of cloth and laid him in a manger, because there was no place for them in the inn.
Our second reading is for St. Anne, whose symbol is the door, by Jan L. Richardson in Night Visions, Searching the Shadows of Advent and Christmas. Who is also the patron saint of lost objects? Who we know only be legend? Who was the mother of Mary, who became the grandmother of God? Who must have taught her daughter something of boldness, of clarity of passages, of the power of choosing, of not fearing angels or their wild propositions? Who beckons me in this season as I seek my one threshold from many doors? Whom I beseech, bless me for all my lostness, light fire to my shadowy sight, withstand my gut-born guessing, my passion for the night. Hallow the endless hallway of doors lined frame by frame, guardian of the threshold, cry out my newfound name, that we may know the power to embrace or to release, to welcome or to turn away, to agree or to dissent, to speak or to keep our silence, to open or to close, and to know each choice that lies before us. O God, we pray.
Every time I go back to Indiana, where I grew up, there's a ritual, and I try to keep it to myself because it's I repeat the same things over and over again to Mary, to my kids. But there's this tendency when I'm driving down certain roads to go, that's the house where my great-grandmother lived, and that's the farm where my great-great-great-grandfather settled in the 1840s, and there's the church that my mother grew up in, and all of this is visible from the highway as you go down through this farm country near Kokomo, Indiana. What's interesting is that growing up, going to many funerals in these small little family cemeteries around that area, going to family reunions in those churches and some of the homes there, I recognized that none of them were my own home. None. They were all extended somehow, but they always felt like home to me. Because home wasn't just about where I lived, it was this sense of belonging, having a place to belong. Home. So many in our day are homeless and don't have a place to belong. I remember years ago when we first started participating in the cold weather shelters. And before we actually had it at Trinity, our volunteers went down to the drag and at First Congregational Church and participated there. And if you've ever been to that particular cold weather shelter, it's a little different than the one we do at Trinity. At Trinity, we have homeless men, and there are places for homeless women and children, but on the drag, they are often, and most often, youth. And their stories are painful. Many of them have been on the streets out of choice because of being kicked out by their parents. Some of them were kicked out or left because they were gay or lesbian. Some of them have struggles with mental illness, but all of them are people without a home. And they hang out there, and they find their home among each other. But on cold nights, that's not enough. And so those churches open up and provide a place. And I remember Dick Shockett describing to me some of the people that he encountered one particular night. And with tears running down his face, he said, "These are people without a home. They're without a home. Can you imagine that?" So I think of that every Christmas season because of the cold and because of the message and because of this story about Jesus moving from one place to another place. Luke and Matthew weave such a beautiful, powerful story, and they want us to not only read the images, but feel the images, feel the despair. This passage that was read just a moment ago ends with a line that they didn't have to put in there. They don't elaborate on it. But Luke wants us to feel it as a closing. And he says these words, "Because there was no room in the inn." Think about that. There was no room in the inn. Now it's interesting when we look at it historically. Scholars have tried to unpack the story. We know, for instance, now that this tax that was going on at the time of Quirinius, who was governor of Syria, happened at a different time than Jesus would have been born. So we know one thing right from the beginning. When we're looking at this story, we're not looking necessarily at a story of a specific history, we're looking at a story of soulfulness, a story of spirit, a story that it takes us on our insides and pulls it back out again. What the historians now know is something Luke wouldn't have had that specific information about. The Gospel of Luke, the Gospel of Matthew were written somewhere between 70 and 85, a whole generation after the time of Jesus. And so one of the wonderful things that happened, and many of you had Bible classes in college or have even taken them in churches, you know this, that when you read a story, you read not only the content of what it's talking about, but you try to find out as much as you can about when it was written. So for instance, and I've used this illustration before, if you read Arthur Miller's The Crucible, and you'd have no sense of when it was actually written, you would think that that story was all about what? The pilgrims, right? About Salem. But when you know that it was written in the 1950s, in the middle of the Red Scare, and that Miller was trying to weave a story about the present by using images of the past, you get a whole different understanding of what that story means. So when we do the same thing with Luke and Matthew, we begin to grasp this incredible story that was very, very powerful. Luke, think about Luke and the things he includes later on in his gospel, and you get a hint of what he's trying to communicate here in this birth story of Jesus. Luke is the only gospel that mentions the Good Samaritan parable. Did you know that? It doesn't appear anywhere else. Luke is the only gospel that mentions the prodigal son story or the loving father story. Think about what those two stories try to communicate. They're all about not having a place in the world, being on the margins, not belonging. And so at the very beginning, Luke wants us to know that the one that we are following didn't belong either. There was no place for him to be born safely in an inn, in a home. And so we get this idea of a refugee family going from Nazareth. And distance-wise, it's not a huge distance, but it is quite a journey if you're walking, which they would have been, from Nazareth down to Bethlehem. And they're going there because of tax rolls. Now, it's interesting that even though we can't match up the evidence historically of Quirinius and Jesus' birth, we can look at what was going on around the year, after the year 70, in the Roman Empire. And they were very specific about registering your place of residence. And you were to go not to the place where you currently lived, but the place where your family resides. And so the readers throughout the Roman Empire would have been reading this story and would have gone, well, of course they had to go to Bethlehem, is that if that's where Joseph's family was from, they would have had to travel from Nazareth to register in that place, because that's what we all have to do. The Romans were pretty meticulous about their records, particularly when it came to knowing who was where and what they were up to. And so we get this image very quickly that Jesus was on the margins, was born on the margins, and that if you want to understand the gospel of Jesus Christ, if you want to understand his ministry, you have to begin on the margins. If you start anyplace else, you simply can't get it. And so when Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan through Luke, we get the image of someone who, a Samaritan, of course, was someone who was discarded as lesser than by Jews of their day. And so it was the Samaritan that was the hero in the story, not the good, faithful Jew. And later in the prodigal son, it's not the older son who does everything right that ends up being the hero of the story. Neither is it the younger son. It is the father who pushes back through convention and loves both of his sons in their own unique way, in spite of the one messing up. What kind of gospel does that communicate? And so as the early church is struggling with its identity, saying, who are we in this Roman imperial system? Who are we spiritually? They learned very quickly that we are nothing if we are not about being on the margins ourselves with those who are on the margins. And so in some ways, it was as if they were choosing to be homeless, choosing to be wanderers, in the sense of being willing to move from the place of comfort, the place where you can drive down the highway and go, that's where grandma lived, to some other place that's unusual, a place that's different, a place set apart. What does it mean then for us as people of faith today to move with that same kind of intentionality? To recognize that in this birth story is our birth story. A birth story of incredible love that knows no boundaries, that requires us or calls us not to sit from the center where we're comfortable in all the ways that we're comfortable, but to start from the margins. That if we don't start there, we're not going to get it. I'm so overwhelmed with the rhetoric that's going on around this country about race. And I know I've talked about it, and I'm going to keep talking about it, folks, because it keeps coming up. When white people, well-meaning, liberal white people, even, try to make comments and understanding of what's going on, we often just don't get it. And the reason we don't get it is because we're starting from some other place, right? We're starting from a place of privilege, a place of power. So maybe it's not up to us to make the comments, but maybe it's up to us to leave the center, to leave the comfort zone, to leave the privilege, and go on the margins and listen to the people that are suffering. And let them be the ones that create the voice that is needed by all of us to be transformed, to be liberated, for new birth, a birth of profound transforming love to happen. And it doesn't just work that way with race, of course. It happens in all aspects of our lives. Economics, education, gender identity, sexual orientation. We simply cannot get, no matter how empathetic we are, what another person who's different from us is going through. But we can join them and sit with them at the margins. And maybe in doing that, there is some path that we will find together. The early church was so radical because they knew to start at the margins. And if they started there, there was a place for everyone to join in. But if they started at the place of privilege, they were always going to exclude some group. Years ago, I read this wonderful book called The Man Who Listens to Horses. Did any of you ever read that book? It's a nonfiction book, but the novel, The Horse Whisperer, was based on this man. His name is Monty Roberts. And Monty was a traditional cowboy, rodeo circuit, raised on a ranch in Montana. And he learned to break horses like everyone else. But there was always a discomfort for him. He felt like there was something that was not correct about that. And he began to just intuitively do something different than break the horses. He began what he calls to join them. He realized that they were herd animals. Animals who were afraid. Animals who survived in the wild by being in their herd and trusting a hierarchy within that herd of who was dominant and who was less dominant, and trusting that. And even though that didn't protect them completely from predators on the outside, it did create more assurance. Well, they've been domesticated so long that we forget that they are those kind of scared, non-trusting animals, except when that trust is earned. And he began to join them. And here's what he would do. He would walk in an arena with a horse that was absolutely been abused and terrified. And he would turn away from them. And he'd just wait. And he says the curiosity of the horse would start looking over. And if he moved a little bit, the horse would jump. But then eventually, the horse, just out of curiosity, began to move closer and closer. But the temptation to turn and pet, nah, he waited. Sometimes he'd wait for a couple of hours. He could stand there waiting. And then he'd feel the nuzzle on his neck, the sniffing. And he would slowly begin to move his hand. And within minutes after that happened, he was able to climb up on the back of that horse. That horse trusted him because the horse knew that he was safe. He called it joining in. Luke wants us to know that the way to birth Christ in our lives is not to stand and pontificate, not to articulate an inclusive theology from a distance, but to join with the people on the margins. And even if you don't get it yourself, that's okay. Just go there and stand and wait and watch what begins to happen. And you'll find that you're part of some grand joining of inclusion, a grand birthing of love. And that's the reason for the season. Amen.